Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In her new book, The Profiteers, Bechdel and the Men Who Built the World, today's guest, investigative journalist Sally Denton, details the rise of the construction giant Bechdel, from its early days erecting the Hoover Dam through its global business empire, building airports, pipelines, a $7.2 billion port and industrial zone in Abu Dhabi, nuclear plants, and even a city in Saudi Arabia. Sally Denton reports that Bechdel has had closer ties to the U.S. government than any other private corporation in modern memory. No other corporation has been so closely linked to the presidency from Dwight Eisenhower on. For nearly 100 years, Bechdel has operated behind a wall of secrecy with its continually evolving military-industrial prototype. She writes, quote, "The Bechdel story is most important for how the company embodied the rise of a corporate capitalism forged in the American West that over the decades took the world by storm, a capitalism much more in line with cronyism than free market ideology. Bechdel pioneered the revolving door system that now pervades both U.S. politics and the American economic system, a door that came to shape foreign policy, not always in the interest of the nation and its citizens, but for the interests of multinational corporations. In the end, this is the ugly, untold story of America, a story not of the triumph of laissez-faire capitalism, but of profiteers whose sole client was government itself." Sally Denton is an investigative reporter, historian, and author of many books, including The Money and the Power, American Massacre, and The Bluegrass Conspiracy. Her new book is The Profiteers, Bechdel and the Men Who Built the World. And Sally Denton joins us from the KNPR studios in Las Vegas. Hi, Sally. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. And wow, congratulations on writing such a well-researched book. Bechdel is based here in San Francisco, and I remember in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, a lot of people protested in front of Bechdel's offices, but people weren't really talking about the company. First off, why did you decide to delve into the history of the Bechdel Corporation?
Well, it's really interesting. I grew up in Boulder City, Nevada, which was the company town for Hoover Dam, which was built in the early 1930s, and actually grew up in a home overlooking Lake Mead that was built by one of the engineers on the dam before the dam was even finished, and the iconic white structure that backs up the Colorado River and Black Canyon there that straddles Arizona and Nevada, and the dam backs up the river and created Lake Mead, which took many months to pool behind it. But so it was a kind of a known name to me from the time I was a little girl. I never stopped to think about what the iteration of Bechdel would be, or the evolution for the next five generations, but until I started looking into them, and it really kind of began as a cover story that I did seven or eight years ago, I think, for Science and Technology magazine, one of the imprints of American Heritage magazine. They had asked me to do a story about the 75th anniversary of Hoover Dam, not because I was an investigative reporter, but because I'm an independent historian and who had grown up there. And so I had no idea that the company had gone from, you know, this mega project in the American West during the Depression to go on throughout the entire, to build on every continent in the world. So that was basically the genesis of it.
So Bechdel is the fourth largest private company in the U.S. after the Cargill Food Processing Company, Koch Industries, and Dell Computers. This is according to Fortune magazine. Bechdel claims to have completed more than 25,000 projects in 160 countries. We're talking security, environmental cleanup, oil, gas, chemicals, nuclear power, telecom, mining, minerals. For a company with such a wide reach, why do we know so little about it?
Well, it's not by accident that we do. It is, first of all, it's very unique in that it is a company that has been controlled by five generations of Bechtel men since 1930 all the way until currently, and which is highly unusual in the United States. We have, you know, we have some family companies, but none that have continued through all five, you know, five generations and succeeded at such an extraordinary level. That, you know, for starters, but primarily it's that it's privately held, as you mentioned. And I think most people don't understand what that means, the difference between a publicly traded corporation and one that is privately held. It creates a shield of privacy that is pretty difficult and or challenging for a journalist like me to pierce, which is one of the reasons I think it's been so off the radar for so many years here, almost 100 years. It doesn't have to file any reports with the Securities and Exchange Commission or have public shareholder reports or any oversight from Congress or, you know, the normal chains that its rivals and competitors have to deal with, such as Halliburton or Fluor or Lockheed Martin or et cetera.
And why is that?
Why don't they have to do that?
Right.
You mean? Because if you're, the privately held status is different from a publicly traded corporation, it's not regulated by anyone.
So no public stock, no public records, no public reports, no public scrutiny. What was your experience like in doing research for this book? Because you report that Bechtel's public relations stance is aggressive toward critical news reporters and authors. One reporter said Bechtel has a three-point PR strategy, trashing journalists to report critically on the company, spinning financial institutions who lend the company money, and bending the truth. So what's your experience been like?
Well, I found that, you know, you can't have a multinational company of this magnitude working throughout the world and practically every country with what they claim is 50,000 employees and you can't do that in a complete vacuum, no matter how much you want to. So I was able to really kind of pierce that through a fellowship that I had at the Library of Congress, which was a fantastic opportunity to really mine the databases throughout the world that the Library of Congress subscribes to, as well as publications and books that have been written on different aspects of projects that Bechtel's been involved in. So actually, that the bibliography, if you see my book, the notes are, I think, 100 pages, and I can't remember how lengthy the bibliography is, but it's quite extensive. There was a lot of information in the manuscript division of the Library of Congress, for instance, you know, especially some of the principals of Bechtel that went on to work for government and vice versa. There are public documents relating to them, a lot of public information, primary and secondary sources relating to the projects that they've been involved with throughout the world. So it was not as daunting as one would have thought. In addition to that, the company itself has financed and published three significant histories over the decades, and so there was, including one, you know, Bechtel and Arab Lands, where, you know, they're boasting of the numerous projects, and their website is brimming with information about the projects. So even though they've got a lack of kind of official transparency, they certainly have made sure that their accolades for the numerous projects are delineated on their website.
So how would you describe this company? Again, they say they have completed 25,000 projects in 160 countries on all seven continents. How would you describe Bechtel?
Well, I think it's kind of the quintessential multinational. What really intrigued me, I'm a fourth generation Nevadan, and so very kind of Western centric. And what really intrigued me about it when I first started looking into it for a book length work, which is about 4 years ago, that I think I've spent about 4 years on it, it was really as kind of an example of the first mega company in the American West. And they come together to with a consortium. This is very, you know, San Francisco centric as well. Mm-hmm. Their first project is Hoover Dam, which is the largest public-private project in the history of the United States up until that time, maybe the world. But it was, they wanted to build, the U.S. government wanted to build a dam. It was the Herbert Hoover administration. There's a real kind of mythology that's developed around the construction of Hoover Dam as if it were a Depression-era project by FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, to put Americans to work, when in fact it was really conceived and manifested by the Hoover administration and really to harness the Colorado River for energy for Southern California. And there was nobody, Hoover, who was had a lot of relationships with California businessmen, really wanted a Western company to build it. And there was not a company in the American West that was large enough that could really tackle a engineering and technological feat of this magnitude. So 8 companies came together from the American West, including Morrison Knutson and Kaiser and Utah Construction and various companies. They named it 6 companies officially after these the Chinese Tongs of San Francisco, the power that would divide up the profits in Chinatown. And and Bechtel took the lead. Bechtel was the leading partner, and by the end, Bechtel assumed the position of the head of the consortium and considered it their signature project. So it really, for me, it was really looking at, you know, the evolution not just of this one little company who, it was a road grader, Warren Bechtel, the founder. I mean, he was basically a road grader and laying track for railroads in northern Nevada and California. But how do you expand from that into this mega company to rival any of the eastern companies?
As a native Californian, it was really interesting just to read about the history. You write that in 1919, Bechtel received, under Warren Bechtel, the first federal highway contract in California. He first built the Klamath River Highway near the Oregon border, the scenic byway considered an engineering marvel at the time. The following year, he built another highway for the federal government in Los Angeles that ran through San Gabriel Canyon. And then the General's Highway in Sequoia National Park, a highway system in Yosemite, followed by contracts in New Mexico and Arizona. So those of us who have been lucky enough to enjoy the beauty of California have come in contact with Bechtel's work. In fact, we do it on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. And that was really, I mean, if you follow the rise of the company, it's really, this is the rise. It begins with the automobile, and then the necessity for roads, and then the necessity for oil. And so the evolution follows this path of, the transcontinental connection through highways and then through pipelines. And it's a fascinating, fascinating tale. And they, were obviously in on the ground floor of, what becomes the one of the most amazing, I think, political and business stories of our time.
The other part of your book that's really incredible is the part about Bechtel's relationship with Iraq. You report mm-hmm. that Bechtel arrived in Iraq in April 2003 along with U.S. troops, even before George W. Bush had declared the war over. Bechtel got the first lucrative government contracts to rebuild Iraq, and the influx of Bechtel engineers into Baghdad came immediately after Saddam Hussein's palace was bombed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, there are many, many ironies in this book, including the fact that, this is a rapidly anti-government company that owes its entire fortune to the largesse of the government. So, and Iraq is just one of many examples of that. Original Steve Bechtel Sr. Was built the palace that would become Saddam Hussein's Republican Palace, which then becomes the headquarters for the American Embassy. The Bechtel's fortunes are tied to this 50-year history of building the palace, getting the encouraging George W. Bush to go to war, getting the first major lucrative contract to rebuild the entire Iraqi infrastructure, the power grid, the water supply, hospital, roads, bridges, etc., and then ultimately leaves. But the irony of this palace being then the heart of the American occupation. And as I said, that's just one of many ironies in this story throughout the Middle East as well as throughout South America. And it just happens over and over again.
And we'll talk about that in a minute. But the things that you reveal, like, for example, Bechtel was among a handful of firms that made sizable political contributions to the Bush's Republican Party before they received a secret invitation to bid on the lucrative post-war government reconstruction contract in Iraq. And then you also write that even before the UN Security Council authorized military action, or before asking the UN to authorize military action against Iraq, the Bush administration had been quietly soliciting proposals for rebuilding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's clear that the Bush administration was determined to go after Saddam Hussein long before it was officially sanctioned. I think that this is not unusual, and I don't mean to suggest that the political contributions from Bechtel to the Bush administration resulted in this. Bechtel was first at the public trough long before and independent of actual political financial contributions. It's really been at the forefront of this regardless. In fact, if you compare the kinds of political contributions that Bechtel makes to political parties versus what many other construction and engineering and multinationals do, it's kind of a miracle that they remain at the forefront of these contracts regardless of what they do, and it's bipartisan often. Mm. They share more under a Republican administration, but they did fine under Clinton as well.
Right. I was going to ask you that. So many corporations now tend to give to both sides. Is there any, what happened under the Clinton administration with Bechtel? Any major differences?
They got, there were some contracts, I think, in Kosovo, and I just don't think they suffered. It's not like the Bechtel corporate headquarters, there's a Democrat elected, and they scratch their heads and say, what are we going to do for 4 or 8 years? They are so entrenched that they manage to do fine regardless of who's president. And that dates back, before Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson in Vietnam, Nixon. So it's really a continual thread that doesn't, I think it reached its apogee under Ronald Reagan, but certainly they do fine. They've done fine under Obama. They're managing the nuclear weapons facilities. So it's really, it's a mystery. Well, it's not a mystery if you read the book.
And the book is called The Profiteers, Bechtel and the Men Who Built the World. And it's written by Sally Denton, an investigative reporter and historian. And Sally reports that Bechtel has had closer ties to the U.S. government than any other private corporation in history. Even though it preaches the gospel of the free market, the Bechtel family owes its entire fortune to government contracts. So what questions do you have about Bechtel? It's based right here in San Francisco and has connections to so many things that we all use on a daily basis. Highways to Yosemite, highways to Sequoia National Park, BART. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. 8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Now, Halliburton got a lot of attention for obvious reasons in the lead-up to the invasion because of its relationship with Dick Cheney. And you write that, you know, ironically, on the whole, Bechdel was completely overlooked by the media during that time.
Well, it's been overlooked for generations, which is really, you know, kind of, I think it's revealing in itself. It's not an accident that it's overlooked. I think they go to great lengths to make sure that nobody's heard of them. And in fact, there's, you know, there's this wonderful quote of, I think it was Stephen Bechdel Jr., who I think Newsweek wanted to interview him, and he said, there's no reason, he declined the interview, saying there's no reason for people to hear of us. We're not selling to the public. So, you know, they have this kind of sense that the public doesn't have a right to know or a need to know what they're doing, that what they're doing, and this dates back to the pre-Cold War and post-Cold War kind of ideology that what they're doing is in the best interest of the United States government, so, you know, don't worry your pretty little heads about it. So I think it's really, you know, Halliburton at the time, because of Cheney and the relationship with the Bush administration, bore a lot of the brunt of this. And I'm sure Halliburton wonders, you know, and wishes that it could deflect some of its negative. I'm sure a lot of rivals probably wish they could deflect some of the negative attention that comes on them, that that Bechdel escapes because of the private nature of the company. Another thing I found really fascinating was that one would think that there would be all kinds of litigation, that these rival companies that are, you know, mega multinationals on their own, that I thought when I got into this and beginning the research that I would find all kinds of litigation between all these companies that are, you know, anti-competitive or competitive and charging, you know, monopoly or anti-competitive practices. And there was a stunning lack of any litigation involving Bechdel. And I learned later that that's because most of they require an arbitration clause in the partnerships that they have, so that if there are disputes, they are handled through arbitration, which is essentially the privatization of the judicial system. And I mean, this whole book is really about privatization.
And because you do report that, like so many corporations, Bechdel preaches the gospel of the free market, but the family owes its entire fortune to government contracts.
Yeah, that's one of the great ironies, and it's certainly not just Bechdel either. And that's, you know, this is not a gotcha book. This is 400 and some pages, and it's not like there's one thing in here that some reader is going to read and say, wow, you know, Bechdel's an evil company. That's not what this is about. Bechdel is not an evil company. Bechdel is representative of the corporate excess that America, the direction America has been going for several decades now. So, I mean, I single Bechdel out because I thought it was a fascinating company born and bred in the American West. But it's certainly not aberrant. It's not unique by many terms except for its private corporate stature.
Sally Denton is author of the book, The Profiteers, Bechdel and the Men Who Built the World. Sally is an investigative reporter and a historian. And in her new book, she reports that no other corporation has been so closely linked to the presidency from Dwight Eisenhower on. For nearly 100 years, Bechdel has operated behind a wall of secrecy with its continually evolving door. So what do we need to know about Bechdel and how it has extended its business from California to far corners of the world? Bechdel is located here in San Francisco. And so what questions do you have about Bechdel and its business operations and the influence it has on both the U.S. government and also U.S. foreign policy? We'll talk about that more after a break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Lots of ways you can take part in today's conversation on Your Call with Rose Aguilar. On the phone, it's 866-798-8255, or you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. or just leave your message or question on the website, yourcallradio.org. Again, if you'd like to join live on the telephone, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-TALK. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. And following that at noon today, Ira Glass and This American Life.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with filmmaker Dawn Porter about her new documentary, Trapped. States across the country are aggressively chipping away at abortion access. Targeted regulations of abortion providers, or TRAP laws, are forcing clinics to comply with onerous policies that are designed to shut them down, and it is working. So tomorrow we'll talk about this. We'll also talk about how clinic workers, lawyers, and advocates are fighting to keep abortion safe and legal. And then Friday, it is our media roundtable. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are speaking with investigative reporter and historian Sally Denton about her new book, Profiteers, Bechdel and the Men Who Built the World. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about the corporation Bechdel, it's the fourth largest in the United States behind Cargill, Koch Industries, and Dell Computers. You can give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ruth in Berkeley. Hi, Ruth. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I wanted to mention I saw a wonderful, exciting film about Bechdel. It did not mention it by name, and the film is called Even the Rain, and it's about an attempt to take over the water rights in a country in Central America. I believe it was Bolivia. I'm not positive, but it was very, very good acting, and as the Berkeley audience was leaving, everybody was muttering, Bechdel, Bechdel, Bechdel. Anyway, it's called Even the Rain, and it was showing for a week about a year or so ago in the theaters, and I hope people can catch it. It's a very good film, and it tells a whole lot about how, and it was a populist uprising against them, which actually won.
Right. Yeah, I saw that film. So it took place in Cochabamba, Bolivia. Did you see the film, Sally?
You know, I didn't. I'm familiar with it, and I did. Cochabamba is included in my book, and I did some research into it. I'm kind of surprised. I didn't see the film because I felt like I knew the story from other research I had done. But I'm surprised that it didn't name Bechdel outright.
Hmm.
I didn't even realize that.
Yeah, I remember. I think I don't remember the name they used, but in reviews, Bechdel is named. Mm-hmm. And so basically, it's about Bechdel privatizing water resources in Cochabamba, which led to very high rates of water for mainly low-income people.
Yes, and very there was an uprising against it, and they ended up leaving the country. And they're also, you know, this is not this is another area of privatization that's happening in the world today as well. And Bechdel is very much at the forefront of that. I mean, they've been at the forefront of resources throughout the world, oil and natural gas and now solar and Ivanpah, the big, solar in various parts of the American Southwest, but also water and throughout the world. So, and asteroids as well. So, it's the privatization of resources.
Mm. What else can you tell us about Bechdel and the privatization of water?
Well, you know, I don't know that much about what they're currently doing. I know that they're buying up water rights in various parts of the world. And that's just, you know, they are at the forefront of kind of harnessing energy and have been since the 1930s. So they've got a prototype and a model for making that work from oil and gas to nuclear energy to solar energy. To water, and as I said, now to asteroids. So I think that's an avenue to keep an eye on And again, it's not just Bechtel. This is major energy companies throughout the world are looking at all of the natural resources. And then also I describe moving. They're moving from the Iraq reconstruction into what's been called disaster capitalism, mm-hmm. which is to go and, you know, with climate change, there's so much change happening in as far as climatic events. And so a lot of companies are, and especially Bechtel, are at the forefront of being there. You know, they were the first, they got the first FEMA contract after Hurricane Katrina to build homes. And so, you know, that's a whole new economic market for the world that is getting larger and larger.
Well, thank you for calling in, Ruth. I'd like to see that movie again, Even the Rain. It was really good. I hope you can all get a chance to see it. To the point you just made, Sally, about disaster capitalism, Larry writes in and says, please reference Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, who details how he personally worked for the State Department to enslave third world countries with debt, and then how Bechtel profited from that.
Yeah, you know, I saw that book a long time ago, and I didn't rely on it so much because it seemed well, the Wall Street Journal slammed me in a review last week. It was actually so hilarious. It was so biased, but referred to my sources as a hit parade of leftist gadflies. So I purposely didn't rely on Confessions of an Economic Hitman, just because I thought it would be kind of an easy target to dismiss me with. So I chose to do my own research and probably came to the same conclusions that Perkins did.
Hmm. Well, right. So what about the arguments that he makes? I mean, he was involved in this, he says. The State Department would enslave third world countries with debt, and then these multinational corporations would profit.
Well, I think that's absolutely, I don't think that's even disputable. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the history has a strong record that details that. And like I said, it's not just Bechtel. They are not aberrant when it comes to this kind of foreign policy and relationship with countries that are enslaved. And then we wonder why they're reactive and resistant to this kind of imperialist notion.
Well, thank you for the email, Larry. Bill writes, what is the tax profile of Bechtel? Do they avoid taxes and shelter their money overseas? Do they pay their taxes from their San Francisco base?
You know, I don't really know what their tax situation is. I know that they have, and I would not have access to that. I know that, you know, they're not known for sheltering abroad, so even though they operate throughout the world, because it's privately held, it's most, you know, the profits go to family members. And so I would imagine that they do not skirt taxes in the United States.
And you report that in 2013, they voluntarily reported their revenues of about $38 billion, but they're not subject to federal SEC regulation.
Right. I mean, you have to take everything at face value that they say. So, you know, they report their profits every year, but there's no way to double check that. So you just have to rely on what they say. But say it is $37 billion. That, to me, raises further questions. As I mean, there's a lot of companies that are report much larger profits that are not as powerful, which comes down to, you know, kind of one of the recurring themes in my book, which was, you know, it doesn't matter what their profits are or what their political contributions are. They still are at the forefront of all of the major contracts in the world.
Well, thank you for the email, Bill. Today, I am speaking with Sally Denton. She's author of The Profiteers, Bechtel, and the Men Who Built the World. Sally is an investigative journalist and an historian, and she reports that Bechtel has had closer ties to the U.S. government than any other private corporation in modern history. And even though it preaches the gospel of the free market, the Bechtel family owes its entire fortune to government contracts. If you have any questions for Sally about Bechtel, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 855-866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Erica in San Francisco. Hi, Erica. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering if Sally could talk, you guys got into it a little bit, but about Bechtel's environmental track record, but also their foundation, their corporate foundation arm. And the reason I ask is I used to be a grant writer for a mid to large size local nonprofit, and I was supposed to find funding for environmental issues, and I always felt really yucky about going to Bechtel with that. But also, they had a really sort of innovative environmental education giving program that went away when the officer who developed it left, which kind of left me with a sour taste as well. So just curious what Sally's thoughts are on those issues.
Okay. Thank you for that, Erica.
Erica, I didn't look that closely into the foundation. I know that they recently, I think that the Stephen Bechtel Jr., Stephen D. Bechtel Foundation is spending down its spending everything, and I think that, just recently it was at, kind of at the tail end of my book. I think they were buying some property there in Golden Gate Park for conservation purposes. Because I was really focused on their environmental cleanup contracts that they're getting throughout the world, from Chernobyl to Three Mile Island to the Hanford, nuclear waste. I didn't really look at the Family Foundation very closely, so I know that the primary interest of the Bechtel Foundation throughout the last decades has really been a Boy Scout camp, but it's not something that is either deeply negative or wildly positive. It just was not much of a factor in my approach.
Can you tell us more about what they want to do with that chunk of Golden Gate Park?
I don't really know. It's just I just saw what was reported in the San Francisco newspaper, I think, about it. But it was, it was lauded as some wonderful conservation preserve. So, and with the company is in the hands of Brendan Bechtel, the young, fifth generation. And so it's possible that it's going to have a different sensibility than he would have, that he could be different from his father and grandfather and great-grandfather. Maybe it's going to, and he's got a education from a Eastern school, and maybe he's going to, take the company in a new direction with this younger generation.
I just found a press release from 2013 from Golden Gate National Parks Conservancy about a $25 million gift from the S.D. Bechtel Jr. Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And so they says it's going to lead to park enhancements in the Presidio.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also...
That's, I think, about as much as I know about it.
You also report, Sally, that like the Koch brothers, the Bechtel Foundation and individual family members contribute to the Heritage Foundation, the Anti-Environmentalist Pacific Legal Foundation, and the American Enterprise Institute and other conservative think tanks.
Well, that's as I said earlier, there's a strong and a legacy of... very anti-communist, an ideology that is very, free market, keep government out of our way, anti-communist containment of the Soviet Union back from the Cold War, leave us alone to do what we do best, and, know that we're operating in the best interest of U.S. government and U.S. foreign policy.
Well,
and those are the organization enterprise. Those think tanks are in line with the classic kind of neocon arguments that we've seen in the last 10, 15, 20 years.
Right. What would you say is the major difference between Bechtel and the Koch brothers, for example? Because we recently had Jane Mayer on to talk about her book, Dark Money, and she reports that the Koch brothers are using philanthropy to really soften their image because, unlike Bechtel, the Koch brothers have received a lot of media attention over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jane's a colleague and friend, and I know that there is a very, you know, there is a very different, I would think that the Kochs, and she mentions Bechdel and Dark Money, so there's an alliance of, you know, they're kind of in the same milieu, but Bechdel hasn't been really actively involved in trying to change the political process the way that the Koch brothers have. I mean, really influencing newspapers and congressional jurisdictions in the same way. So they're different that way. And also, you know, they've been really kind of, the Koch brothers have been out front and center in their agenda. I mean, there's also a lot of shadowy initiatives, but they've really garnered a lot of attention. Bechdel, it's so funny to me because in the United States, you know, I've been 4 years of researching this, and I go to various places, I speak, people ask me what I'm working on. Nobody's ever heard of Bechdel in the United States unless you're in San Francisco or Boulder City, Nevada, or Boston, I think, with the Big Dig. But if you go anywhere else in the world, it's a household name.
Hmm. Well, and so when you talk about what it does overseas, I mean, you have a lot of information about Bechdel and U.S. foreign policy. How would you describe Bechdel's influence on U.S. foreign policy?
Well, I think it's so integral and symbiotic, and I think that's what the shock was to me when I started out in this book. I thought, wow, well, Bechdel, you know, because it goes back. This isn't a new thing. This goes back to after Hoover Dam. Warren Bechdel dies mysteriously in Moscow. The son, Stephen Bechdel Sr., becomes partners with John McCone, who was also a California businessman, Consolidated Steel provided the steel for Hoover Dam, which was an unbelievably huge contract, as you can imagine. And after the dam was completed, Stephen Bechdel and John McCone formed a partnership called Bechdel McCone for a while, and they built Liberty ships, or, you know, warships for the U.S. military leading into World War II. And then McCone goes on to go into government rather than the private industry, and so they split it, and then it becomes Bechdel alone again. But McCone goes on to become the director of the Atomic Energy Commission, and then ultimately the director of the CIA under JFK, and LBJ keeps him on. So the relationship between Bechdel and national intelligence and foreign policy is really forged back in the run-up to World War II and the Cold War.
You also have a really interesting story in your book about Jonathan Pollard. You call him America's most controversial Jewish prisoner. And Pollard served nearly 30 years in federal prison in North Carolina for passing classified information to Israel during the early 80s. And he got a lifetime sentence, which you point out is kind of unprecedented because he was spying for an ally of the United States, not an enemy of the United States. And you write that in the middle of this world, the heart of the case of Jonathan Pollard, and the connection to the Bechdel Corporation is that Bechdel executives turned Reagan cabinet members, Caspar Weinberger. You write that he went to great lengths to ensure that Jonathan Pollard would never be free to tell his story, a story that would have included Bechdel's longstanding business relationships with Israel's enemies in the Middle East, especially Saddam Hussein. I mean, I read a lot about Pollard in the last couple of months after he was freed and didn't read anything about this.
I know. He was finally freed, and that was he was granted parole after 30 years, which was standard. He wasn't pardoned or anything. But he was it was indisputable that Caspar Weinberger, who had been Bechdel corporate counsel, who then became Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan, he was determined. And as corporate counsel with Bechdel before joining the Reagan administration, he would have negotiated and legally vetted whatever contracts Bechdel had with Israel's enemies throughout the Middle East. So he then goes to Washington in the Reagan administration, and during the Pollard case, Pollard was guaranteed that he would, if he pled guilty, he would get a 2 to 4 year sentence. And instead, there was a sentencing memorandum to the judge by Casper Weinberger that it still remains classified. Parts of it have been declassified recently, but there's no dispute among anybody involved in this case that the reason the government reneged on its deal, its plea agreement was with Pollard, was based on this determination by Casper Weinberger to establish that what Pollard had done really was treason and qualified for a life sentence.
To your knowledge, has Pollard talked about any of this?
Well, he talked about it before. He, you know, in fact, he gave an interview to Wolf Blitzer when Wolf Blitzer was at the Jerusalem Post. It was interesting to me that Wolf Blitzer had nothing to say about Pollard upon his release recently. The official story was always that the government reneged on its deal with Pollard because that he violated his agreement with the government by giving an interview to the press, meaning Wolf Blitzer. So Pollard, since his release in November, this past November, has been very careful not to give any interviews, and I think is, in fact, there was one reference to him. He was supposed to give a keynote or a speech somewhere and canceled it at the 11th hour because he was, you know, he's under, I mean, the last thing Pollard wants to do is say something that's going to get him, land him back in jail. Hmm. He's trying to be, you know, go back to Israel or go to Israel to live.
We're speaking with Sally Denton. She's author of The Profiteers, Bechdel and the Men Who Built the World. I want to ask you, if we're almost out of time, but you write about the revolving door between Bechdel and the U.S. government. And one of the major players in Bechdel was George Shultz, who held three cabinet positions in the Nixon administration, first as Secretary of Labor and then Director of the Office of Management and Budget and then Treasury Secretary. And he was hired by Bechdel just 3 months before Nixon resigned with a $400,000 salary. You write that this was emblematic of modern Bechdel. Can you just, what really struck you the most about what you found out about George Shultz?
Well, it's not that what I found out about George Shultz as much as that kind of became emblematic of, you know, what Bechdel, I argue that Bechdel created the revolving door, which is so ubiquitous now. It's pro forma for every American company. We barely blink. There is a cooling off period, but it doesn't seem to bother anybody. But this dates back to, it didn't start with George Shultz. I mean, this happened back in the 1940s and 1950s. When Bechdel was hiring people from the U.S. government, and they would go back and forth from Bechdel to the U.S. government. And if you're talking about, you know, say somebody in the Nixon administration who's making $70,000,
$80,000, $90,000. Am I still in the air?
Yes.
Oh, sorry about that. I thought we just lost our electricity. So we're still live, but we just dropped Sally Denton. I couldn't hear myself earlier. Well, sorry about that. We've been speaking today with Sally Denton, and her line just completely went dead. Sally is author of The Profiteers, Bechdel, and the Men Who Built the World. And we're going to try to reconnect with her. We don't really have that much time left, but we were hoping to ask her some questions about Bechdel's connection to BART, Bechdel's connection to PG&E, and then she was going to finish talking about the revolving door when you've got politicians going to work for Bechdel and then going back. And she says that Bechdel really started all of this. Well, actually, why don't we just take a caller, and then hopefully we'll reconnect with Sally. Let's go to Jim in Richmond. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to, it was very interesting, and follow up on the foundation. I was glad to hear that there's some money for parks in San Francisco, but over in Oakland, the foundation is part of funding of a takeover of 56 acres of parkland in Nolan Park, and this has been with the okay of some of the city council members.
Well, Sorry, Jim, go ahead.
No, I was just a concern about privatization of public parkland.
Yeah, actually, you know, we should put that on our show list because I think that would require an entire show. And unfortunately, I cannot ask Sally because we don't have her back yet. But we will put a link to the information that we learned about Bechtel giving $25 million to the Golden Gate National Parks Conservancy. I know a lot of people are concerned about the privatization of parks and public space. So we should put that down on our show list. Thank you for calling, Jim. And again, I'm sorry, something happened. And we lost Sally, but I think we might have her back. Hi, Sally. Sorry about that. Not sure what happened on your end.
Oh, okay.
We had a quick question from Jim about the privatization of public space. He says that Bechtel is also involved in a private-public partnership with the Oakland Zoo.
Oh, I didn't know that either. You know, there were, when you're talking about 25,000 projects throughout the world, it was, you know, kind of hard to keep up with absolutely everything. In fact, I didn't even really try. But yeah, the larger story here really is the private public partnerships. And I think if any, you know, if what I would like readers to take away from all of this is a real look. And T.J. Stiles, the historian T.J. Stiles, reviewed my book in the Sunday New York Times this past Sunday, and he raises this question really of, you know, this is the dialogue, this is the conversation that needs to happen. This concentration of wealth and the public trust. And I think that my book is really kind of a primer for that. It's not that I set out for it to be that, but that's certainly I think something to look at in all of these public-private relationships. From prisons to utilities to the nuclear weapons labs to the Oakland Zoo.
Right. Well, Sally Denton, thank you so much for joining us. Sally is author of The Profiteers, Bechtel, and the Men Who Built the World. Sally is an investigative reporter and an historian. Sally, thank you for joining us and thank you for your reporting.
Thanks so much.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with filmmaker Dawn Porter about her new documentary, Trapped. States across the country are aggressively chipping away at abortion access. Targeted regulations of abortion providers, or TRAP laws, force clinics to comply with onerous policies designed to regulate them out of existence, and it's working. So how are clinic workers, lawyers, and advocates fighting to keep abortion safe and legal? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.